Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today, Chris Stone, the host of Real Space Strategy and Senior Space Fellow at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, is joining us, and we are talking about Iron Dome for America. The president has recently signed an executive order to go forth with Iron Dome. And so we thought we'd bring Chris on because Chris knows about things that rockets and space and that kind of stuff, talks about it on a regular basis. And so I thought, who better to talk about Iron Dome for America? And of course, if you're watching this on audio, he's got his Captain America shield in the background, which I just now noticed. You know, it's kind of, and make space great again. So he's, you know, he's got a great hat on as well. So, Chris, welcome into NucleCast.
Thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So the president signed an executive order. Tell us what was in that executive order.
Well, this is a very interesting one. As you mentioned, the title was Iron Dome for America. And obviously for those that have paid attention to missile defense related issues and wars in Israel over the last decade or so are familiar with the Iron Dome system, which is a very impressive system that is meant to protect the Israeli population from small rockets and missiles that are coming inbound from various threat areas, to include the Houthis, Iranians, the Hezbollah folks in the north, Hamas in the south, you name it. If something's fired toward Israel, Iron Dome is there to prevent mass casualty events due to those missile strikes. And the president would like to have one for the United States of America, obviously a much bigger issue to tackle than Israel, and to address all the various threats, both air, missile, and even space related, that could hurt or harm critical infrastructure and or the civil population of the country. Some of the missile systems and other threats that was specified in here include ballistic missiles, hypersonics, advanced cruise missiles, and other next-generation aerial attacks from peer, near-peer, and rogue adversaries. So, as most people probably know that listen to your program, the current missile defense system that we have are either the small theater-based missile defenses like Patriot or THAAD, and then we have our ground-based interceptors in California and Alaska that are meant for the, you know, onesie-twosie potential rogue launches and or accidental launches, as well as the Aegis Ashore system that's supposed to be going into Eastern Europe sometime soon. And that's about it. In order to have a total continental coverage type situation, this one includes space-based interceptors, sensors, and the like. So that's very exciting for a space person who's been arguing for space weapons for defense and offense for quite a while. And then the last thing I'll mention, so you can be more specific in your questions, is that unlike other similar technology-based EOs of the past, this one is not just a, hey, I want some information, get back to me with a study in 20, 30 days or, you know, a year. This one wants a full requirements list, budget, con ops, everything ready to go in 60 days from the date of the EO, which was January 27th. So it is, but the good news is, as we'll talk about probably in a little bit, is that quite a bit of the stuff in here that's to be considered part of the system. It's just taking current programs of record, putting them together under this one umbrella, and trying to expedite the deployment. And so 60 days, and they want budget for 26. So if you think just the technology development and deployment is rapid, they want to get the budget to and a 5-year plan for the FYDP going as early as FY26, which that budget should be out by now. But since we don't have a 25 budget yet, most likely that budget is delayed until probably May, according to some observers. So they've got a little bit of time to figure this out, but not a whole lot of time.
So when we think about Iron Dome, particularly, you know, the Israeli Iron Dome, you know, that is able to handle, you know, homemade rockets from Gaza and, you know, drones from Iran and maybe sort of slow moving cruise missiles and, you know, simpler targets over a, you know, a country the size of New Jersey. But when we talk about Iron Dome for America, we're talking about, you know, it's significantly larger. It's, you know, going to have to take out hypersonic cruise missiles glide vehicles that can maneuver. It's going to take out, you know, reentry vehicles moving at, you know, Mach 15. It's going to take out, you know, all sorts of low observables, you know, all sorts of stuff. Is, I guess the question that I had is, just as I think about this, is how feasible is it to build the system that can do all that? And are we going to build 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1? And if we're just going to talk about sort of existing nuclear arsenals, right? Because it's going to ensure that we can, that we have a survivable second strike. Are we going to need to take out, you know, the Russian arsenal plus the Chinese arsenal plus the North Korean arsenal? So do we need, you know, 2,000 to 6,000 of these interceptors? You know, kind of walk me through what that might look like and sort of what is that going to cost us?
Yeah, that was a lot of stuff. So let me start with a little bit and I'll work my way up. So the way the executive order seems to be looking at it from is taking current programs of record that are already funded and kind of packaging them together. As some were considered already, such as the HBTSS, the hypersonic space-based sensor from MDA, Missile Defense Agency, and the proliferated space warfighting architecture from SDA. And all those are going to work together, and they were going to be working together to be part of the sensor packages. Then you have the current missile warning space surveillance architecture that we have, the space fence, some of the other efforts that are ongoing to try to help track stuff that's traveling through space and coming into the atmosphere, as well as the low flyer. So it doesn't look like they're asking or expecting a lot of heavy lifting like SDI was, Strategic Defense Initiative was back in the mid-80s when they were saying, hey, let's develop this and deploy it with all these fancy schmancy things. I think, you know, obviously you'll want to get there. And it doesn't even specify what a space-based interceptor consists of. So that gives them a little bit of flexibility. But I think what you're going to see is a multi-layered sensor suite, multiple orbits, ground, terrestrial, things of that sort. And then you're going to have a multiple-layer space, air, sea, whatever, interceptors so that you have multiple opportunities to get the target, whatever it is, before it hits a homeland or a overseas base or things of that sort. Since it's primarily focused on the homeland, I don't think it's going to require a global coverage. It's going to primarily focus on the homeland and the critical infrastructure needed to, you know, for our daily lives of our citizens and home bases. So I don't think it's going to be a global system. So that's going to change the orbital basing and where you want to put things. Things of that sort. So the idea, as I can see it, is looking for near-term stuff, quick-turn deployment, and get something up there as soon as possible. I don't think we're looking at, you know, the old Spies Like Us movie with the Zenith stars with the laser cannons and the mirrors and all that. We may eventually get to that, but I think he wants something done in the next couple of years if you want to if you want my opinion on it, especially when you put all the budgeting and everything done for FY26 budget.
Yeah. So then you probably would see this as not necessarily a solution to the entire Russian and Chinese and North Korean arsenal, but just it's a starting place to sort of get the ball rolling and start to build out a system that offers us the defensive capability that just doesn't exist right now.
So I would say that if you look at what the EO says, the executive order says that it is dealing with peer, near peer, and rogue states. So it does deal with all the major players that we're concerned with. It's not so much a counter to the weapons and their bases in their home countries as much as it is intercepting the threats from boost phase, which we don't have right now. Mid-course, which we have a very few missiles on the West Coast that can do some of that for onesie-twosies. But this one, obviously, for a much bigger mass approach. And then for, potential other things, if you use the ground-based things and other layers to intercept on a terminal or as it's going through the atmosphere. Ideally, you want to get it before it gets to the atmosphere, so any debris and stuff can go into the atmosphere and burn up and not create any chances of secondary hazards depending on the payload. If it's a biological weapon, a chemical weapon, a nuclear weapon, you don't want to spread all that mess everywhere. It's better to blow that up in space. And the other thing you will see in here, that it's not just kinetics, even though kinetics are the priority clearly, but they also have the ideas of non-kinetics as support mechanisms and things of that sort. So I think it's primarily focused over the homeland and U.S. territories such as Alaska and Hawaii, maybe Guam, but I don't think it's looking at covering the entire planet. But we'll have to see what happens with that. And space-based interceptors could be anything. So I think that's important to keep in mind. But we want to make sure that given the rapid buildup, the so-called nuclear breakout in China, the fractional orbital bombardment systems being tested and demonstrated, coupled with who knows what kind of weapons, including the high-powered microwaves or the hypersonic glide vehicles, very important to keep that in mind. So I think that's what it's looking at covering.
Yeah, I guess I wonder, just in terms of, budget-wise, will this compete with our nuclear modernization, for example? Because, as I was looking at MDA's budget and looking at, they're getting some new, they're GBIs, but they've got a new name, like next gen or whatever they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty expensive. They're not cheap. And, they have their probability, hit to kill probability is lower than, a nuclear weapons PK in terms of striking its target. And so I just wonder, I wouldn't call myself anti-missile defense, because I do love Herman Kahn's perspective, and he of course advocated for defensive capabilities. But I do wonder, in a constrained environment where we're already spending more than 100% of federal revenue on entitlement programs, which of course crowds out defense spending, how do you afford a potential Iron Dome for America that may need thousands of interceptors? And the Russians have already said, in response to this executive order, that, we'll just build more and you'll have to target more. And so, I'm not a big advocate of saying, we want to avoid arms racing. I don't really mind that per se, but I'm just trying to think through what is your best, return on your investment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one where I've yet to be convinced that an Iron Dome for America is that best return on investment. Am I missing something? What's your take on that?
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
Well, I would say from an there are two things, and I think from an educated guess, one of them would be financial. A lot of people on the arms control side argue that it costs too much, it's not technically feasible, and that it's strategically destabilizing. I don't agree with any of those arguments, and I think some of those arguments may have made sense 15, 20 years ago, but on cost, a good chunk of that cost of getting systems like this up was launch cost. And when I first came in the Air Force in 04, we were on a good year launching 5 to 6 launches a year from Cape Canaveral, maybe one or two from Vandenberg. And now with reusable SpaceX rockets landing and reusing and the potential of Starship Super Heavies launching massive amounts of payloads at once and reusing those, the launch cost has dropped exponentially. And so that's one thing. So that's one of the boogeymen that's not really there anymore in my mind. The other thing is there are a lot of innovative ways that people are looking at doing space things, whether it's be space weapons or space support architectures and things of that sort. So a lot of the when people say, oh, it'll cost us a lot of satellites, it'll be hundreds of satellites, it'll be thousands of satellites. Well, we're already building constellations that have hundreds and thousands of satellites in them. So it's just a matter of what kind of targets are you looking at hitting, and how many of these kinetic kill vehicles or whatever it is you're going to use that's been developed over the last 30 years. Where do you put them? How many of them does it launch? And what's the cost of the launch? And you're not going to be using these every day, so you're not going to have to replenish them all the time. But if you have the ability for like a Starship Super Heavy or a New Glenn or something that has the ability to launch massive amounts of small vehicles, if you could scatter them around the Earth, put them in the right orbits and planes so that they're ready to go, and you could refresh them fairly regularly, I think that will take care of a lot of that technical feasibility argument and take care of some of that financial argument. And the strategic stability argument, I also find hard to really believe, is, as you mentioned, Herman Kahn. I'm more of a Kahn, Keith Payne kind of guy. Defenses are not destabilizing. And the whole idea that they're arguing is, oh, if we do this, then other countries will want to do it and everything will no longer be benign. Well, space has not been benign for at least 20, 25 years, if at all, during the entirety from 57 to forward. Weapons are being deployed. They are being used on a day-to-day basis. It may be on a lower threshold than a standard kinetic ASAT, but those have been demonstrated. They have the will to use them, and they're building way more ICBMs and FOBs and all these other systems. So the argument that somehow if we take our responsibility to provide for the common defense, somehow we're going to destabilize something when the other side is already doing all the destabilizing activity, I think that's laughable, and I think that is totally irresponsible. A country's job is to protect its citizens. And so I'm of a Herman Kahn mind that you want to have a credible deterrent. So you mentioned nuclear modernization. I don't know if that'll impact nuclear modernization, because my other educated guess on the side of the finances is the Doge Group has been looking for billions and billions of dollars of savings across the entirety of the executive branch. And I think that could lead to the ability to reallocate the funds that are necessary, as well as you have people on the Senate side. I think it's Senator Wicker is now in charge of SASC, who says he wants to increase the defense budget to be closer to a more reasonable percent of GDP. And then I think Senator McConnell, who's in charge of SACD, the appropriators, has also said similar things. So it's just a matter of prioritization. If the adversary, the Chinese, and the Russians to some extent, but primarily the Chinese, looks at space as the place where wars are fought and possibly won before they get to the terrestrial thing. I saw Heather Wilson, former Secretary of the Air Force, make the comment using the tired old language of wars that extend to space, war will extend to space. Wars will start in space and extend to Earth. That's the reality. That's what they're looking at, because that's where the vulnerability is. So you have to plug the vulnerability. And so I'm not so much worried about the funding as I am about that some of the other services may have to take a hit in order to get the space force and the space layer where it needs to be. Otherwise, we're going to continue to have this big gaping hole for the adversary to target and to harm us. And I think that's unacceptable.
But what if we just show the Russians and the Chinese that we mean them no harm? Won't that? Of course, I'm joking, but you know, that's so.
We've tried that since the 90s, right?
We open up
the trade pipelines. We say, yeah, if we do all this, you know, economic interdependence, globalization, it doesn't work. We're back in the great power competition, and competition is not some nebulous thing that just kind of goes out there. And I know people have said China is the pacing threat. And for those of you that are NASCAR fans, I'm not so much one, but I'm going to use this analogy of NASCAR.
Okay.
The pacing car at a race leads their other cars. Every car follows the pacing car.
Yeah.
How is that a competition? If you're following the Chinese and they're your pacing person, you're not really winning anything. So why not win the competition? And they're obviously in an arms race. They're building it up. They have the largest Navy. They're growing to the largest Air Force. Ours are still dinky small. And in order to get through such a high-end threat environment terrestrially, space is a good spot to deal with this. And I think that's why whoever wrote this for the president understood that this is a need that we should have built 20, 30 years ago. But we were trying to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. And obviously, great power competition / crisis warfare stuff is back, and it's time to accept that reality.
Well, so how about thinking outside the box in terms of, as you were talking earlier, I was thinking, well, could instead of building expensive missiles that, you know, we launch from, you know, CONUS, what if we just had a layer that sat atop the United States, and those, you know, were satellites that could, you know, you've said that space is weaponized, and you know, the essentially is the Outer Space Treaty, you know, is it sort of out of date? Is it irrelevant? Is it worth the paper it's written on? And if not, then why don't we just set a layer, you know, a defensive layer in space on top of the continent, such that it can sit from the high ground. And then whenever a threat comes, reaches it, or is below it, it can, you know, strike that target above or below or as it's coming, and do something other than sort of the traditional bullet hits a bullet.
Well, it doesn't have to be a bullet hit a bullet. It just says space-based interceptors. It doesn't say what kind of interceptor. It could be a bunch of kinetic kill vehicles. It could be some other item that may be in development that we're not aware of that could do it in, like I said, those mass formations that can do what they need to. Per the Outer Space Treaty, as you mentioned, that is it worth the paper it's on? None of this will violates the Outer Space Treaty, because there's nothing in the treaty that says you can't deploy conventional weapon systems or defensive weapon systems in orbit. It just says weapons of mass destruction. So nuclear, chem, bio, you can't do that. Now, obviously, with the Russians looking at nuclear ASATs again, those are currently supposedly ground-based, which gets around that, but they could still put them in orbit using a fractional orbital bombardment system. Just because the word fractional is on there doesn't mean that it can't. Right. If it wants to, if they just put a little extra stage on top, they can put it into a parking orbit. And there are even some lawyers over the years who have argued that a temporary deployment may not violate it. Even if it is a nuke, it may not violate the treaty because it's not a permanent one. Now, I don't necessarily buy that argument, but there are people who have made that argument. So you never know what the other side will use in these forums to do that. But it doesn't have to be a bullet hitting a bullet. But you know, it is going to be kinetic, and it also says it needs to have non-kinetic support types of systems. And I just threw out there the ground-based ones like GBI and all that stuff, because you know, you're going to want it to be layered. You want your sensors to be layered, multiple orbits. You're going to want, and terrestrial, and you're going to want to have as many possible ways of protecting whatever it is you're protecting just in case it doesn't work exactly right. So we'll see what that is. I mean, we may not actually see what it is, but in my mind, you should say what you've got, you know, as a deterrent. I don't necessarily buy that defenses can be a deterrent. I think defenses are a good thing that couples with it. I don't buy the Thomas Schelling model of, oh, let's hold all the cities and the people hostage under this stable balance of terror thing. I think that's crazy. And I don't think the president probably supports that, given the fact that his concern in this, they use the phrase counter value. And so that means population centers and critical infrastructure. It doesn't say counter force.
Yeah,
so
true.
That's something to keep in mind as well with respect to this project.
Well, we are at that time where, I mean, you've had some great ideas, but now let's rub the magic lamp and let Bob, the genie, come out. And of course, Bob's going to give you 3 wishes. So now you don't just have to speculate on the realm of the possible. Now you can tell me what you actually want.
Okay.
Chris, tell me, what's your wish? What's your first wish? What's your biggest wish?
My first wish is that they actually do this correctly the first time, and the bureaucratic process doesn't stymie the issue. So hopefully Secretary Hegseth is watching the process as a hawk and is keeping an eye on all this with his staff members, since a lot of his appointee counterparts have yet to come into the building. So that's one thing, is that the bureaucracy doesn't stymie it and slow it down and prevent implementation like what happened during the first term. Second thing is I want to see space-based interceptors that can be used in multi-role capabilities. So not just, you know, space to boost phase intercept, but also as anti-satellite weapons on orbit. Because not every threat that could harm the homeland is necessarily flying a ballistic flight path or a maneuvered flight path in the atmosphere. You know, there could be EMP, you know, vehicles placed in the orbit and parked there and used later. There's been hearings about that going back into the late 90s with concerns of North Korea, their KMS 3 and 4 being potential test beds for EMP, given the public source information about how the Russians and Chinese have been sharing nuclear tech and EMP designs with the North Koreans. So, you know, because we're dealing with all 3 of those major countries, and the Iranians are mixed in there now too, and they're starting to cooperate a little bit more, you know, that's one of those things to keep in mind. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing, I think the Space Force should be the one responsible for everything that's in space as part of this system. Anything that orbits the Earth should be Space Force controlled. The space-based interceptors, whatever that ends up being, needs to be ran by Space Force operators. And I think U.S. Space Command, which for some reason wasn't mentioned in this EO, just NORTHCOM and STRATCOM, which I get it, you know, Missile Defense Joint Task Forces and all that kind of stuff are those. But Space Command, you know, its original mandate was to protect against threats 100 kilometers and up. And I hope that they change the UCP back to saying that language and get away from the facing downward approach, because if you take care of the threat in space, it won't be a threat on Earth.
Yeah. Well, those are 3 great wishes. So I think I'm going to encourage Bob to do his best to make sure they happen. So thanks for those. So, you know, we're out of time, but I wanted to give you sort of a elevator pitch opportunity. To, you know, what should our listeners walk away from the executive order, walk away from all the articles that have been written as of late? What's that thing they need to think about and understand in regards to Iron Dome for America?
Well, the first thing they need to think about is that this is not something to make fun of. They made fun of SDI a lot back in the day, calling it Star Wars, and that was not a term of endearment. That was a term of derision. This is something that is realistic. It is achievable. It is doable. And it is vital given the type of world that we're living in and as it's going to be continually developing. If they want to go to bed at night with at least a good percentage chance of surviving an event like this, if the Chinese or the Russians decide to put us at the homeland at risk and not just our allies overseas, which is totally likely. We need to plug the vulnerability gap, and this is one of the areas that's important to do that. So I would recommend that they call their congressman and senator, tell them to support it, regardless of what their congressman or senator's party affiliation is. Clearly, the Republican side, depending on who they are, but majority of them typically are more supportive of these types of endeavors. And the Democrats are typically more opposed and more pro-arms control and things of that sort, which is partly why we haven't seen a whole lot of progress over the last 4 years on this at all. And because of the split Congress, the previous administration had a lot of trouble getting things done too. So if 2027 is what intelligence considers the chance of a major crisis with China coming up, that's not that long from now. And if we don't get this started and deployed in the next couple of years, we're going to be in a world of hurt potentially. And that's totally unnecessary given the technology and the resources that we have at our disposal.
All right. Chris Stone, thanks for joining us on NucleCast. Thanks for the discussion. It was a great one.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunkel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.